So what this is about, listen, y'all, this is probably, in my opinion, one of the most important, well, outside of all yesterday's lectures, which is about management, this is at least, if not more important. This is quantifying the quality of habitat you have out there. And this is real. And you are required as a wetland biologist, waterfowl biologist, for a state agency, for U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, to go through the process of calculating duck energy days. This is a standard in our field, and it's a pretty progressive standard, in my opinion. There aren't any white-tailed deer energy days, or quail energy days, or fish energy days. The waterfowl folks have really kind of paved the way in looking at quantifying habitat and quantifying how many birds we can potentially sustain in an area. And it's a very good method to figure out whether or not we have enough habitat out there, quality habitat out there, to support the continental population of waterfowl. And every agency, state agency, Fish and Wildlife Service, every refuge has goals of duck energy days that they need to be meeting. And then they go through management, they attempt to meet those. And then they're evaluating, calculating these on an annual basis, because obviously management is changing on an annual basis. So today's exercise is basically to train you in how to calculate duck energy days. And this afternoon specifically, I'll give you an assignment. And the assignment is relatively computationally intensive. But the activity we'll do this afternoon will be a base. We'll actually what you heard over during my presentation at the TWS hunting dock doing different scanners, which are, in my opinion, probably the easiest way to predict at least seed yield and ultimately use that to calculate duck energy days. Okay, everybody have the handouts here? Oh, one other thing, you can, for Monday, 24th of March, when we, I guess, before lunch, when we break or whatever, if you will pick at least two of these topics, I may not lecture on both of them, but pick two of them and turn that in, and I'll definitely lecture on the one that has the top vote and possibly the second one, just depending on which one. Some of these lectures are longer than other lectures, so it kind of depends on what top. Okay. So before we talk about duck energy days, I'm going to explain to you all what the North American Waterfowl Management Plan is. And underneath the North American Waterfowl Management Plan, what's also called NAWMP, the acronym, NAWMP, is evaluation criteria, duck energy days, which used to be called duck use days. So sometimes I'll say that. And then we'll talk about estimating food resources. You're going to hear, you've already heard from the Tennessee chapter meeting, but again, now you have the opportunity to take notes. I updated this lecture last night and uploaded it like 10 at night. So if you print it off the slides, you don't have the most updated slides, but you can take notes for the slides you're missing. All right, so first and foremost, we've talked about waterfowl, where they breed. The majority of them are breeding, again, up in the Prairie Pothole region and basically the, up in Canada and up into Alaska. And then as things get cold, they start staging in August, and they start to migrate south, okay? They do not just migrate randomly. There are historical corridors in which are called, in which waterfowl migrate. And these are basically band returns over the years of birds being shot. And you can see that you have a group of birds in the Great Lakes region, et cetera, in north eastern Canada that come down the coast. You have a large number of birds that come down the Mississippi alluvial valley, and then you have a fair number of birds that are coming through the pothole region, through the Playa Lake region, and all the way down to coastal Texas, and then another group of birds that come down the Pacific coast and through the riverine systems of the Southwest. And each of these biologists have put names on each of these corridors. There's the Atlantic Flyway, there's the Mississippi Flyway, and over half of the continental population of waterfowl come down the Mississippi Flyway. Around 80% of the mallards that are produced in North America end up wintering in the Mississippi Alluvial Valley. Then you have the Central Flyway and then the Pacific Flyway. Okay, give you a little bit of history of why the North American Waterfowl Management Plan was conceived. This is basically our waterfowl populations through just last year, and going back to 1955, Fish and Wildlife Service and Canadian Wildlife have been estimating population levels, and there's a group of surveys they do in May and also in July, and where they're flying transects across this region in a plane across the prairie pothole region and all the way up into Canada. And they're counting, first of all, in May, they're counting the number of ponds that are out there, the potential habitat. And then in July, they're out there and they're counting the number of broods they see. And they have, in Washington, D.C., the Patuxent Wildlife Research Center, that take all those numbers, and their job is to take those numbers and crunch those and put those into a model and predict population levels. And they use lots of different variables, and they come out and they predict the population levels. And this has been going on now for 50 years. And so we've been able to come up with really good estimates for the past 50 some years. And you can see that basically populations have kind of fluctuated over time. And in the 70s, really waterfowl biology and management was really starting to take off. And waterfowl hunting, for that matter, was taking off. And levels were really, as you can see, at a pretty decent level. And then in the 80s, numbers started to decline. And at least in recent history, most folks didn't really kind of remember this decline, or didn't really observe this, because there weren't very many waterfowl hunters back in here. Folks were really becoming concerned for this decrease in waterfowl numbers. And this is the long-term average right here that Patuxent has calculated. That's 37.5 million birds. I'd write that down. 37.5 million birds. Not the long-term average. That is the average during the 1970s. The average during the 1970s. Okay. So in 1985, basically waterfowl had reached an all-time low in recent years, and again, biologists were extremely concerned. So biologists in Canada and have to plan managing waterfowl. We need to figure out what's going on here. We need a collective effort, because obviously we know what goes on in Canada influences the populations in the United States, and what happens in the United States is going to influence the birds that return to Canada. So this really has to be a multinational effort. Okay. So in 1986, the North American Waterfowl Management Plan was conceived, and the it broke, first and foremost, it broke management of waterfowl up into four different jurisdictions that were based on basically the flyways, the waterfowl flyways. So you had the Atlantic flyway, the Mississippi flyway, Central flyway, and the Pacific flyway. And management of those is all the management in Tennessee. You have to come up with an agreement with all these states, have to agree, as well as Canadian Wildlife Service. So you talk about management. Now what happens over here in the Atlantic flyway, you don't even really worry about them. You really focus on what's going on in your own flyway. And they set harvest regulations and primarily harvest regulations, but the management is then implemented through another process. And that's, I think I have that on the next slide. So, all right. Any questions with that? 50% of the North American continental population. Biology, there was a lot of science being done. There were a lot of waterfowl hunters out there, and that's why it became a concern at that point, just because of the weather. Yeah, we are certainly declining here, yes.
Is there a
reason for that? Yeah, quite interestingly, if you look at the number of May ponds, basically is an indication of how wet the and I kind of showed that yesterday, or whenever I talked about value, that was on, showed that how our populations, they track the number of May ponds up in the, number of ponds in May, up in the prairie pothole region. The bottom line is you need to have water habitat, brood habitat. And so these, one of the concern right here was agriculture. They were really concerned that basically agriculture was having a really negative impact, and it certainly was in many capacities in the prairie pothole region. Again, we talked about, you know, these are prairie nesting ducks for the most part, and you know, if you have agriculture right up to the wetland, there isn't any nesting habitat for them, or if it's just a very narrow band, predators can very efficiently go through those narrow bands and either predate the nest, or like fox will even predate the hens. So, and there was a lot of research being done in the 80s that was documenting those types of effects. So, lo and behold, actually, you know, the Farm Bill was conceived right about this time too, and underneath of the Food Security Act, that's when conservation programs started to be implemented, conservation reserve program, etc., and there started to be conservation within the prairie pothole region with respect to grasslands, etc. And lo and behold, this number increased. And I was starting graduate school right here, and I don't know, just in looking at, I mean, if you look at the number of May ponds, you look at the number of ducks, I mean, it goes up and down. I mean, they follow each other like almost a perfect correlation. And I don't know, I kind of called a little BS at that point. I mean, I felt that, you know, Certainly the more habitat you have out there is a good thing, but you know, it seems that water is important for ducks. And that's probably what's driving it. And we're just, this is probably just cycling through a natural precipitation cycle. Well, they increase, and you know, I mean, through 2000, and now we're decreasing again. Well, if we're decreasing, is there less habitat out there? Is there are we up these conserved areas? Well, no. No, this is tracking, again, number of made ponds. So certainly these conservation programs and having intact grasslands for, you know, but first and foremost important is you got to have water. They can nest all they want, but if they can't take their brood to a flooded wetland, then the brood's not going to survive. And that reduction is significant. Number of ponds is the most. Yes, nesting is important as well. And in large blocks of nesting habitat, the probability of predation is important. There's so many factors that go on out there. I mean, you know, you don't know how much of this is a result of conservation programs, but I'm sure there is some effect. Okay, so in 1986, the North American Waterfowl Management Plan received. There was agreement at that time between the United States and Canada, and then Mexico was added in 1994. And the goal of the North American Waterfowl Management Plan in 86 remains is to basically restore populations and maintain populations at benchmark levels of the 1970s. Okay? And that benchmark level is 37.5 million. Okay. All right. So, there's a three-prong approach with respect to how are we going to do this. The first is through the protection of wetlands that we have, enforcing wetland protection laws. Secondly, restore wetlands, restore nesting habitat. And third is enhance. For the wetlands that we have, increase their productivity. And this needs to occur throughout the entire annual cycle, the entire range of migratory waterfowl. Okay? So goals here are implemented through what are called habitat joint ventures. The regulations that I was talking about before with the different councils, the different flyway councils, they set regs, okay? But the joint ventures implement habitat goals. And ultimately, they're monitoring and assessing the state of habitat and whether or not we have sufficient habitat out there to sustain the population. So these are all the habitat joint ventures that are out there. And in Tennessee, we have, and you heard Melissa, that's this olive-colored joint venture. Lower Mississippi Valley Joint Venture. Okay? And that comes up into western Tennessee. And then we also have the Central Hardwoods Joint Venture. But that has been just established about 5 years ago. And it pretty much focuses on passerines. The Lower Mississippi Valley Joint Venture focuses a lot on waterfowl, but also other species too, like shorebirds, and also some migratory passerines. Okay. So, with respect to the enhancement aspect, or even the restoration aspect, what we're talking about looking at is, okay, first of all, how much do we have out there? What the joint ventures are? That's the first and foremost thing. How much do we have? Do we have enough out there? And second of all, what's the quality on an annual basis? So the quality of the habitat is what this whole lecture is about, is quantifying the quality of waterfowl habitat in our region. And the way that we do that is through duck energy days. The calculation of duck energy days is a practice in the migratory and wintering areas. An equivalent evaluation procedure hasn't been done up in the breeding area. Pretty much what's been determined as an important correlate is just number of ponds that you have out there. These are the ponds that are out there, the prairie pothole, they're flooded. I mean, it's good habitat. I mean, the ducks, there's pretty good survival. There's lots of aquatic inverts, and so they tend to be relatively productive, assuming that, you know, there is an agriculture right up to the edge of it, and there's a bunch of chemicals washing down into that wetland, as long as there's some buffer going that they have. So quality of habitat is what we're talking about in our region. It's the calculation of duck energy days. Any questions? Okay. Duck energy days is the calculation, it's the formula, and this is a way of calculating waterfowl foraging carrying capacity. And it's not total capacity, this is completely based on food resources and energy. But it's a pretty good of overall carrying capacity, because when birds are migrating and during winter, they have extremely high energy needs and energy demands. So, it was duck energy days as a definition. Okay, duck energy days is the number of ducks that can be sustained in an area for a given amount of time. You should know that definition. And it's a very simple definition conceptually. Number of birds that can be sustained in a given area for a given amount of time. Okay? We can think about duck energy days with respect to the habitat complex we talked about yesterday. So you have duck energy days that are provided by cropland, by moist soil wetlands, and by hardwood bottomlands. And in a particular area, you can add all those things together for total duck use days, total foraging carry capacity on your particular area. So usually you're estimating these separately, and then you just add them all up. One duck energy day is the quantity of food necessary to keep one duck alive for one day. That's one duck energy day. The amount of food necessary to keep one duck alive for one day, based on its daily energy requirement. Quantity of food necessary to feed one duck for one day. Okay. So if you have 5,000 duck energy days in a wetland, you could technically keep 5,000 ducks alive energetically for one day. And usually from a management perspective, you flood areas up, and that makes sense. And your flooding duration is the duration, and often that might be about 3 months or a little bit longer. So usually managers are, well, it just depends on when you're flooding up, but the majority of flooding often occurs around the hunting season, around the also when the birds are here, so from mid-November through January and February. So, so you got November, December, January is 3 months, and maybe part of February or all of February. Okay, so you can calculate then the number of ducks you can sustain during that flooding period. All right, so this is the example that I had before. If you had 5,000 duck energy days, you could support 5,000 ducks for 1 day, or you could support, if you flooded it for 10 days, that would be 500 ducks for 10 days that you could energetically support. Now, will that many ducks be there? Well, that depends on lots of factors, like the birds being down here and using the area. That's why the reason it was changed from duck use days to duck energy days is because duck use days is misleading. It suggests it's termed based on the energy. Yeah, but usually the green tree reservoirs, you're not flooding as much soil. It's because, again, you want to minimize that stress on the tree. So maximum, again, like we talked about yesterday, with flood up and draw down, you don't want to go past 2 months. But you would, for a moist soil area, you could have it flooded for 6 months. I mean, you might, in fact, have, like we were talking about yesterday, one of your impoundments that you flood up in September for blue-winged teal. Other questions? Okay. So, within a particular habitat of the complex, think about two different vertebrates. So, have duck energy days associated with seeds and with inverts, but historically, as far as the calculations, biologists have ignored invertebrates going into this total calculation, primarily because it's considered that, well, ducks aren't eating a whole lot of inverts out there, they don't really contribute that much, and secondly, we haven't come up with a good way to calculate efficiently the number of aquatic invertebrates out there in a wetland. You can go out there and sample with nets and stuff, and then you sort through those and you draw and you weigh those and all that stuff, but most biologists just do not have the time to do that type of estimation. We haven't come up with an efficient way to do that, like the models that we're going to talk about today and that you're going to get intimately exposed to. Those haven't been developed for invertebrates. And, there's some biologists out there that say, well, what's the point anyways in going through all that effort because, ducks are eating these, but as far as contributing to keeping, their energy requirement a day, it's probably not as much as seeds, just based on their diet composition. But I will tell you, the energy content of aquatic inverts is higher per gram than moist soil. The average for inverts is around 3.5 kilocalories per gram, which is about equivalent to agricultural seed. And the average for moist soil seeds is around 2.5 kilocalories per gram. And acorns are similar to moist soil seeds. So they are they do have quite a bit of energy, and they have protein as well, and lots of minerals and important things like that that waterfowl need. They haven't really been considered in these calculations. Okay, so Duck Energy Days was conceived by Harold Prince. Harold Prince is a professor at Michigan State University. And Harold was Rick Kaminsky's major professor for his master's and his PhD. Rick took those ideas and really has been integral in Duck Energy Days become standard with respect to calculating or evaluating wetland habitat in the migrating and wintering areas. He's worked who is a U.S. And Chuck Lesh is one of Kaminsky's students. Anyways, Duck Energy Days are calculated with the following equation, and again, we're trying to figure out, come up with an idea of how, you know, relate the amount of food we have with a group of ducks. So the first thing, we figure out, okay, X grams or kilograms of food, figure out how much energy we have in that food. So we add by the energy in that food, so we have really, now we have a total energy estimate. And then we're going to divide it by how much energy it takes to keep our duck alive for a day. So we multiply it by what's called the true metabolizable energy. That's TME, true metabolizable energy. True metabolizable energy. And that differs from energy. Is actually the energy that a duck can actually get out of that food resource. In the food resource. And that's important. You're going to need to know the difference between those because that works into problem number two on your assignment you're going to be given. Okay? Now, so should gross energy be less or more than true metabolizable energy? It's going to be more. Yeah, it's always and using gross energy value is used, not representative of really what the bird is going to get. But I'm going to force you the problems to use gross energy values so that you can think about it and compare it with the true metabolism. Think about, obviously it's higher. Okay, and for that. All right, so the daily energy requirement of water, then it's divided by the daily energy requirement of waterfowl and kilocalories per day. So, again, these are usually, as I mentioned last week, the ones that are in yellow, the true metabolizable energy and daily energy requirement. Requirements for 92 kilocalories. And I've given you some standards. Oh, I think I have it here. I forgot about it. Another thing down here. Some typical constants that are used for moist soil seeds just across the board is 2.5 per gram. It's 2.7 is the average. But a lot of folks just round it up to 2.5. For your assignment, use 2.47. Aquatic inverts, as I already mentioned, is 3.5 kilocalories per gram. And I have some estimates for agricultural seed a little bit, but they tend to be around 3 to 3.5. Now, in your assignment, what we're going to do, you'll have different plants that might be there or different invertebrates. You can be very specific with this. We have lots of these values for common moist soil plants, and for some herbicides out there. So you can be relatively, you can be more accurate than just what we got here. Values, multiplying. If you have, for example, barnyard grass, you can use the TME for barnyard grass that exists. All right. The other thing to mention is that there are TME takes out of seed, and they differ from other birds. It's a paper that actually has mallard and blue-winged teal. And it may have pintails as well, I can't remember. But you'll have one of your problems will actually be calculating it for mallards and for blue-winged teal and just comparing those numbers. As it turns out, they're pretty darn close. And the one that I'm thinking about, again, it might be barnyard grass, like mallard, get and blue-winged teal. It comes overall to the whole calculations of your duck energy days, you're really talking about very similar numbers. And the point of that is that mallards are a pretty good model to follow. Calculating duck energy days. Okay. The different as I mentioned, kilocalories per day, and that's to keep a mallard alive. That's the standard again.
Is there a difference in the energy requirements for dabbling ducks and diving ducks?
Yeah, is there a difference between the energy requirement of dabbling and diving ducks? I'm sure there is. Most of the energy day calculations have focused around dabbling ducks. That's where I'm frankly, that's version and what it is. There is an equivalent equation. And it's the same, but it's basically the daily energy requirement of the standard of Canada geese, and they figure out how much food they need. I think there are estimates with respect to corn, but also with respect to brown. I think the standard they use is like in the wheat or something like that. And in the wheat, a goose needs to eat per day. Okay. So, I estimate. So we've touched on that a little bit. And I have another slide after this one. Is to make sure that we have up the habitat we have out there that's of sufficient quality to maintain continental populations underneath of the North American Waterfowl Management Plan. That is the number one goal. Make sure, because overall, we need this many duck energy days to sustain the population. Okay, given the number we have out there, this is the number that we need. All right. And we're expecting this many birds to come through the Mississippi Flyway, the Atlantic, etc. All right, Mississippi Flyway, what are your duck energy days? What do you have? Where are we? Meet those levels. Determine sufficient food resources exist on migrating wintering grounds to support the continental populations of waterfowl. And this is all under the North American management. From that perspective, then, as I already mentioned, from a state natural resource agency perspective, and every single wildlife refuge that has the goal of managing waterfowl has duck energy day goals. So you can see within a state, for example, state waterfowl biologist Tim White. Tim gets duck energy day calculations from all the CMAs that are managing waterfowl, and he can look to see which of my WMAs are producing the most duck energy days. And why are they? Is it moist soil? Is it agriculture? How are they getting it done? He can then make decisions as a state biologist of that management here. You guys are doing fine. All right. So there are state goals and regional objectives that this can also be used to evaluate and make sure that, okay, we're short. Tennessee is short this year. What are we going to do next year to make sure that we're not short? All right. And they always shoot as a benchmark that at 37.5 million. Just provide that amount. For example, PWRA's state goal is 3 million. Duck energy days. And if you break that down, often what is used, and I think I mentioned this last week, is 110 days is often used as, okay, this is our flooding period. Again, this is a lot of the state agencies use. Flood up in ultimate. Flood 10 days. With this number of duck energy, National can winter up to 200,000 birds. So, but over 100, of course, not all, you're not going to have 121,000 ducks over that whole period of time. So that's their goal, and they can actually do surveys and see how, and estimate how many birds they have out there and see if their duck energy days are corresponding with the number of birds they have out there. Okay. And lastly is just, again, going from huge to smaller state level or refuge level to even really smaller, which is the main out there, and evaluating management practices. So as you're trying different things, you know, I've threw out a bunch of different ideas yesterday, but the best thing you can do is just yourself, you know, try different things, do different combinations, and go out there and evaluate your management practice. Go out there and disc an area. You might apply herbicide in an area you want to see how plants respond. You might apply fertilizer, you know, so you can use these calculations. Calculate your different types of things. So continue to learn. Okay. Good. All right. So North American waterfowl management goals. million birds. All right, what are our existing population levels? Are we above or below that? All right. The states calculate their duck energy days, as well as I mentioned the federal refuges. And of course, what goes into the state calculations are the WMAs, well, refuges that are state would be state refuges. The feds do it separately, okay? Do their calculations separately. And private lands. Ducks Unlimited is in charge of estimating how much is out. And because there certainly are waterfowl habitats, and what duck tests are doing, and what's out there on the land. Go into waste grain. Southeast added. Food plots, or they're managing moist soil, or they have a reservoir, etc. So. Ducks Unlimited leads those efforts. Okay, so obviously what goes in here is, you know, estimates of food. And again, as I mentioned before, we focus mostly on seeds, or entirely on seeds in these calculations. And so this really emphasizes here, y'all, you know, the importance of having reliable estimates of seed production, grain production, or moist soil, or whatever, acorns. Okay, those get all pumped into here. Boom, you have your state DDs. Those then get turned over to the Migratory Bird Field Office within your region. And within our region, there's a Migratory Bird Field Office that's over in Memphis. Those go to the biologist there, and which is now Bob Ford, used to be Don Orr. Don was the guy that was in the picture when we were talking about Black Swamp, that was standing with Joe Johnson. Anyways, it goes to that biologist. That biologist combines all the numbers for their region, and then ultimately that goes to the joint venture. Highway perspective. We have enough to support. And, well, next year. All the way down. What it comes back is it would come back and say, Tennessee, you're not doing enough. Tim White, all right, who's not doing enough? All right, this is what we need to do. Pretty organized and simple process. But this is all underneath the North American Waterfowl Management. Probably one of the most progressive conservation plans that really exist for managing wildlife globally, quite frankly. Okay, so the bottom line is we need reliable estimates of food production. That's what it's about. Yeah. How much is Kiker Bottoms? Yeah. Bill Smith calculates duck energy days. In fact, he was. Everybody remember Bill? He was the one that was helping with the hawk. He's fun. He was interested in bringing plants up next year to have us scan them and stuff. Bill's a pretty progressive biologist. I'm trying to remember how much he, you know, Bottoms is mostly moist soil units. And I'm trying to remember how much, but we could calculate that. I was thinking it's around, it's either 200 acres or 200 hectares. I can't remember. if it was 200 hectares, for example, and he produced on average 500 kilograms per hectare of seed, then we could calculate the duck energy days, or, you know. But he supports, just as far as birds that respond, he could have a couple thousand birds on his relatively small area. It's pretty impressive. And I mean, up to, heck, I think he's documented like up to 8 or 9 different like waterfowl species. I mean, it's pretty amazing. You see lots of different things now. Any other questions? Okay, so 3 methods for quantifying available food, which I went over last week. What are those? What are the 3 methods? Yep, constants is the first one. Constants, direct estimate, and kitchen. Yeah. Okay, so constants are using numbers from previous research. So, like for example, Melissa's out there. She's across Tennessee. She's been over 2 years basically out there measuring the amount of grain, waste grain in harvested fields. She measures across all these different average, and you as the biologist say, that's good enough for me, I'm using that constant for corn or for sorghum. And there have been similar studies that have been done for more soil. And to a lesser extent, some of those numbers do exist for acorns, but Kaminsky's doing a study right now and really comprehensively looking at acorn production. But there are some constants that are out there. So that's the whole constants. All right, we'll talk about the problems of each of these here in a little bit. Direct estimate is, so you're going out there as the biologist and you're measuring the seed production or the aquatic invertebrate production. So you're collecting seed heads and bringing them back and taking all the seed off, and you'd have to dry and weigh it. Because all of our estimates, our food estimates, are dry mass. Dry mass, not wet mass. So we dry it, take the water out of it, and weigh it. Okay? And then the last is prediction models, which means you measure something else. You know, seed, older, measure biomass. You know, it's doing a direct estimate, but it's pretty intensive. But you're still going in the field. Here, you don't even go to the field. You don't even walk outside. All you have to do is calculate the area of your moist soil unit, which usually you know anyways, maps that somebody else has made. And that's what you want to do. And you don't even go to the field or anything. And so here you're going out in the field still, but you're measuring something that is strongly correlated with food production. And you're putting that into an equation that predicts seed yield. Or it could be invertebrate biomass if you build a model to do that. Okay? Across all 3 of these, number 1 is the most commonly used. And first of all, well, we'll talk about problems with this because nobody's going to do this. And second of all, we've failed in selling this. We haven't marketed this very well. And quite frankly, it's the models we've developed have had problems. So hopefully we won't. Okay, so let's talk about some constants and I'll point out specifically what you'll need to pull off this slide, which is actually down here at the bottom. So if we this is a post-hard right field. Around 140 to 20 kilograms per hectare of seed is left behind the combine. And as we talked about, I think yesterday, work that Kaminsky's former students did, I found out, well, you know what? The estimates are much lower than that. It's around 80 kilograms per hectare. And for 3.3 kilocalories per gram. Grain sorghum, 136 kilograms per hectare. We'll compare those numbers there in a little bit with Melissa's numbers. These numbers are from Texas. These are the numbers that are used by the Lower Mississippi Valley Joint Venture. Actually, I think they use one. Energy in grain sorghum is 3.5. Moist soil wetlands, all species combined, not separated, just on average. 450 kilograms per hectare. There's a study that one of the former students around 500 kilograms. Your assignment you're going to use for the comp, you're going to use 60 per hectare. And the reason is because the that is currently what the Lower Mississippi Valley Joint Venture uses. And you'll have a handout that explains that. The current estimate they use is 600 kilograms. The Lower Mississippi Valley Joint Venture. Hectare in early succession. Average energy is, as I mentioned before, 2.5 kilocalories per gram. Hardwood bottomlands, the way that it is calculated as far as constants is based on the basal area of red oaks that you have. So here are some estimates. You can see, I mean, this is a pretty good illustration of food production in a bottomland, at least with respect to acorns, compared to even, you know, waste grain, but, you know, moist soil wetlands. They aren't producing as much food. And hardwood bottomlands are important. Acorns are good food resources, and there's some aquatic inverts in there. But they're most important for providing those secluded areas that we talked about before. So handout that you'll get has a lot more estimates than just this for food production based on basal area. So you have to go out and you do have to go out and get basal area. You do have to go out there and get your basal area of the soil. Okay. For aquatic inverts, again, all species combined, just on average, it's generally assumed that there's zero aquatic inverts in croplands, flooded croplands. And that's not completely true. Certainly, production, but those estimates really haven't been calculated. But it's low. It's certainly lower than what would be in more soil area or other bottoms. The reason, just in general, biologists haven't really gone out and estimate aquatic invertebrate production. A bit less than biomass Okay. The CME up here, you can see there's a superscript. These estimates assume that there's no precipitation. As the seed deteriorates and decomposes, it leaves. I mean that if you flood for 90 days, 110 days, whatever it is, the energy in that seed is constant. And we know that that's not true. It's a spec for agricultural grains. That, when you put water in agricultural grains, as we talked about before, 90 days, and like for soybeans, 85% of it's decomposed. So now moist soil seeds, certainly, crops, compost, crop seeds. It also assumes that all birds metabolize energy at a constant rate. And again, mallards are used as the model. It's pretty decent, actually. And I think you'll get an appreciation for that by the assignment where you're doing it for blue wing teal. The one problem where you're doing it for blue wing teal and for mallards. Okay, y'all had this yesterday, I threw this up, but available seed in rice fields, again, here's that 80 kilograms per hectare that I was mentioning, basically, that's out there, and that's post-harvest, and it's near that threshold. So this is what Lower Mississippi Valley is using, which is 140 kilograms per hectare. Waste grain, and they're calculating this across the DUs, using it across the landscape for all these harvested rice fields, and also where it's managed on WMAs. That's equivalent to 752 duck energy days per hectare. 78 kilograms per hectare is equivalent to 325 duck energy days per hectare. So you know you're talking again about half of the half of the energy. Really out there, half the number of ducks. That's just think about that, all right? There are a lot of biotics really just growing because of these new numbers. They have been overestimating the number of birds they can energetically sustain by almost double. Now, and that's like, oh my God. I mean, you know, these numbers that we've been using aren't real, and the reality and the answer is that is correct. Those numbers were from the 80s, and things have gotten more efficient with respect to harvesting. We're harvesting with better equipment. We're harvesting earlier, and the other thing is rice. With the other grains like corn and sorghum and soybeans, all of those were done. Those were all done outside of the Southeast, up in Nebraska and Illinois, and a grain sorghum over in Texas. And those areas are much, much different than the Southeast. Out in Texas, it's dry. Things don't decompose very much, okay? Up in the Midwest area, it's cold. In fact, in the Midwest area, there's a biologist up there, Mark Scherfe, that works for GEA, and he's estimating the amount of available. And in February, March, that is in fields. That is not the case in the Southeast. So it's not as humid up there. They get less rain, and it's cold. When it gets cold, it's like a refrigerator. Things just stay there, and they just rising that Melissa's on. And those estimates were the estimates. Those were the only data that existed for the Lower Mississippi Valley Joint Venture to use. using. And as it turns out, there's really very little food out there at all for ducks once they get here in the southeast in fields. Okay. So this really, when it, Keys Group had done Bryce, so in lower Mississippi Valley. So we did the other grains. And you've seen these estimates. And Melissa, Arkansas, Louisiana. So we're probably a best case scenario. Estimates that Melissa has is 17 kilograms per hectare. Okay. I'd probably write those numbers down. Did you write them down?
No,
you can go back. Okay. You'll need those for your assignment. Grain sorghum, again, quite a bit of stuff at, you know, right after harvest, but by January when the ducks get here, 11 kilograms per hectare. Every single one of these estimates is below forage and carrying capacity. When you do the very first column, it could be based on time. Like, okay, there's 11 kilograms per hectare. The first thing you're going to do is you're going to subtract off 50 kilograms per hectare of seed, because that is considered the giving up thing. So we're going to take that off first. Well, if you subtract off 50, what do you get? All right. A negative DED number just means you have zero duck energy days. I mean, if you interpreted a negative DED number, then that would mean that as they're flying over a field that doesn't have any food, ducks are falling out of the air. They're actually killed. Now, that may actually happen. You have enough of those fields in a row, and they're going to have to keep flying and flying and flying. So, or if they waste time, they think there might be food. Their survival. But well, just for the calculation standpoint, if you get a negative number, which you will on some of these constants, it's just zero. Yeah.
If you're basing your management just on DED, do you have a little bit of leeway since you're not taking into account bird rate on food source?
Do you have a little bit more kind of a buffer considering you're not taking into consideration inverts? Yeah, you do. That is a buffer you have, but it's not a big buffer. Remember, it's only 10, 15 kilograms per hectare of food that's usually produced. So it's not that much. I mean, from the overall perspective, like if you have a moist soil field that's in early succession, you're talking about 1,000 kilograms, around 1,000 kilograms of seed per hectare, compared to the aquatic same feet, probably be around 15, maybe. So it's really a small factor. it's not going to give you too much of a buffer, is the bottom line.
Can you go back to the slide?
Sure. Yeah. I just need to write something down. The number that I'd write down is this number here, the bottom. This soybean, corn, January.
So you said that when it's in chapter 15, it becomes a negative,
just make it zero. That's it. It's just zero. That would be, you could, negative 34 equals zero duck energy days. Simple as that. Yeah. You don't even have to do that. You get negative seed production estimate, you just stop there and just say zero DED. All right. So here is, you saw this in the list of presentations. Here are those numbers right here. Back to production. Again, 35, 11, and 17. And this is what the lower Mississippi Valley, here are the duck energy days. This is not even subtracting off of 50. This is just straight calculation here. Okay. That's around 200 and 20 here before you do a... Oh, no. What is she doing here? Why would... I'm not quite sure what she's doing, but great. This is, these are the guys. Her pie charts, I want you to remember. Happening the corn. Yeah. You know, the five fields is just a, I mean, that's a small sample size. So overall, I mean, I think that this is not a great estimate, you know, if you just have five fields, but that's all the fields that we could find, quite frankly. So the energy days, I'm going to have to ask her about that, how she calculated this, because if you just subtracted off 50 from here, from each of these, these would all be zero. So I'm not sure why she has positive numbers here. To corn, what happens to these things? So corn, most of it is depredated, is eaten by other things, which is not surprising. Things like corn, everything likes corn. So they're out there eating it, and including ducks, but a lot of this is happening even before ducks get there. It's pretty much divided equally between being germinated and decomposed. So germinated and decomposed. I'd write these down. It's a great multiplication. Yeah, what I would write down is the majority of that. 70% of it's depredated. And the percentage isn't important. It is. Well, she put out seeds about 3 months here. Yeah. split here. Soybean being germinated and decomposed. And really not kind of surprising with soybean. Decomposed pretty quickly. And then grain sorghum, large percentage was decomposed. The majority was decomposed. And yeah, well, I would animals out there like soybeans better. I don't really know. Decomposing and germinating much faster for grain sorghum than for one possible. Yeah. Well, you know, that's a good point. You know, why are waterfall numbers declining? Again, I think it's probably tracking really closely the amount of ponds that are up. This is pretty alarming overall. We have more efficient combines out there. We have plants that are much earlier. Can happen. There's lots of things that can happen when ducks get here. So overall, there's just food for the ducks. So what does happen when they get here, and can that negatively impact? Well, I would say compared to, you know, the 70s and 80s, there is definitely less food on the landscape, and possibly the 90s than there ever has been. Right. So there's very little that's out there comes to that as far as ducks are concerned. I mean, these are the things that are happening. A lot of it's decomposing, germinating, so it's not even there. So, you know, these fates go into ultimately these numbers right here, okay? These numbers that are here in January. So the fate goes into, all right, this is what's left that's out there. This is the intact seed, okay, that's out there. But what happens to it in the process? Well, before the ducks even get here, they're, you know, it's decomposing and germinating. And yeah. So, yeah. Any other questions? All right, why don't we take a break?